This is The Spark. I'm Martha Woodruff. Guns have become so politicized in this country, it's hard to remember sometimes that they are an integral part of our history. So I thought it would be interesting to talk with someone who invests his time making beautiful flintlock rifles in much the same way they were produced when the United States of America was just getting going. Before health issues intervened, Lowell Harrer made cabinets in the converted chicken house that's been his Rockingham County shop for the last 40 years. Now he makes flintlock rifles there, the long rifles Americans were dependent upon for food, back before the days of modern firearms. Usually he makes rifles, that is. The morning I visited him, Lowell Harrer was working on a pistol.
I need to be able to see. Two pair of bifocals helps.
Tell me what you're doing.
I'm filing this tang down here. The tang is the back of the barrel, holds the barrel into the stock, and it goes on back into the wood, stabilizes everything together, and trying to mate the metal to the wood, so it's a good smooth transition and everything blends well. And we'll get into the wood here and work on it a bit. Usually we start working the wood down with real coarse rasps and then get to finer files and into the sandpaper and get it real smooth. Once we get the wood down to where we want it with real fine sandpaper, we do what's called whiskering. We wet the wood and it raises the grain. And sand it some more and get those little whiskers off until it's just really very, very smooth.
How long have you been working on this and how close to done is it?
This pistol I've been working on probably about 3 weeks. Off and on, I'm working at this at a half-time basis. So it's not like a 40-hour a week, but my time is irregular because I'm a pastor, and so I'm in and out of the shop quite a bit, no set hours. But anyhow, it's been about 3 weeks. I would say I'm about half done with it now, right. Maybe a little over.
Right. And what kind of pistol is this?
This is actually a dueling pistol. Yeah. It's about an 1810 period dueling pistol, and I can't imagine they actually settled disputes like that. Stood there and shot at each other about 15 paces, you know, but that's the way they did. And that's what this is. It's a recreation of that. And this actually goes to Arizona. I've never met this customer, but hopefully he will like it. We've been back and forth on the phone quite often and emails quite often with descriptions of various sorts. And he sent me various pictures of guns that are close to what he wants and different size dimensions from the original and trying to get what will work for him.
So. Why doesn't he just buy an antique? Is he going to have a duel? Why does he want a new dueling pistol?
Well, for one thing, those are very rare, very expensive. And so you get a recreation and some of the originals are pretty delicate. You don't want to shoot them a lot. And so, yeah, just because they are a piece of history and those makers are all gone. And once those guns are gone, I mean, you can't replace them because those makers are all long gone. So, yeah, get a contemporary that's very near the original and you feel free to shoot it. And hopefully there's a guy like me to make more.
On the day that I turned 21, my dad walked in with an old shotgun. He said, "This belonged to your grandpa. It's yours now, son. So I handle it with love and pass it on."
What's a lock?
Oh, okay. The lock is actually the firing mechanism. You have your barrel and the main charge is down the barrel, but you need something that instigates the fire. And in this particular case, it's a flintlock. And that spark, that fire is generated by flint on steel. And so when I talk of the lock, that's the whole mechanism. It's got three springs in it. You know, you've got the cock, which a lot of people would call a hammer. It comes down and strikes a piece of iron the flint does, and that sets off the sparks into what would be called the flash pan, where a little bit of gunpowder is stored outside of the barrel. And so when those sparks hit that flash pan with that bit of gunpowder, it goes through a hole in the side of the barrel and sets off the main charge.
I saw sparks.
Cabinet maker in this shop for 32 years, and various health issues. Why it came apparent it was time to do something else. But what do you do when you're in mid-50s and not trained for anything? Life seems like a trap and a dead end. So I had built several guns through the years, and a few friends said, try that. Well, you know, so here it is 7 years later, and I'm still trying it. I built my first long rifle in 1985 while I was still doing cabinets. I had a young man working here in the shop that had made several guns himself. And he mentored me on the first gun that I built. Said, this is the way you need to do it. And he said why. He was an excellent teacher. It wasn't just like, do this, but he told me why. And it helped me understand the lines of the architecture of a gun, how they should be made properly. And obviously, working with my hands all my life, I had the skills to do it. And I guess I inherited a certain artistic ability from Dad, and hand-eye coordination. And
what did your dad do?
My dad was a farmer and pastor. Grew up in Indiana, dairy farm. But Dad was always very skilled and artistic. You know, he could take a pencil and draw pictures that look very real to me. And so, yeah, I guess it's a gift. You know, you can work hard and accomplish a lot of the same goals, but I naturally want to give my credit to God for giving me the gift and ability and artistic skill. And I think that's where it comes from. And I simply want to take care of that gift and hone it to the best of my abilities. So this one is actually number 48 that I've built, besides some kits. Now, when I do kits, I don't usually put them in my numbering sequence, often don't even sign them, just simply because it's the work of somebody else rather than all my own. And that's a debatable thing in the art world. What do you sign and what don't you sign? And that's the way I choose to do it.
Tell me about why guns of this particular period. It's before modern firearms, obviously, but why?
Okay, to me, there in the late 18th century, right around the Revolutionary War period, and right after that, I feel was what would be called the golden age, art-wise, of the American long rifle. The engraving skills, you know, that you see in the metalwork and the carving in the woodwork were probably at their highest at that point. It's getting toward the end of the what I call the flintlock era. That would have ended about the 1820s to 30s in that area sometime. I just like the flintlock rifle, and it's just got its own fascination. I got into that because of hunting. Love to hunt and to use these kind of guns. And so, sure, it's natural to reproduce them. You know, you try to pick out what was their most artistic age and try to do your best to reproduce it.
When he come home, his politicking was done. Why, the Western march had just begun. So he packed his gear and his trusty gun and lit out a grinning to follow the sun. Davy, Davy Crockett, leading the pioneer.
Now, I've not made any of the barrels. I always buy the barrels. I have made one of the flintlock mechanisms in themselves. Now, that's about as much work to do that as a whole rifle. So it's very time-consuming and expensive. So what dictates what you do and what you don't? Depending on what my customer is willing to spend. I can buy parts and alter them to get the look that I want for the particular gun I'm trying to reproduce, or I can make them. And to make them, obviously, by hand, every piece is individual. It's much more time, labor intensive. That translates into money. So depends. You know, there are some customers out there that want me to reproduce an original as exact as what I possibly can. They're willing to spend the money to do it. And so you end up with pretty much a handmade gun. Then you get somebody else, they want something they can hunt with, shoot with, that's from that time period. And, you know, they say, fine, use castings, use whatever you can find that looks good, and build me a gun. I want your name on it. So, yeah.
Country boy, got a shaggy dog. Country boy, up a holler log. Well, he comes in a run when you pick up your gun, and with a shell or two and your dog at you. When you get your rabbit, you'll skin his hide. He's gonna be good fried. Country boy, you gotta learn to lose. Country boy, how I wish I was in your shoes.
I was watching you when we came in, and you were bent over this lovely piece of wooden metal sanding away. So you're in here by yourself, got a little music on, but what goes on in your head while this is going on, while you're working?
All kinds of stuff. I mean, you know, you run the gamut of, like I say, I'm a pastor, and sometimes I'm thinking about my people and preparing sermons, and other times I'm thinking about hunting, and I'm thinking about the guy that I'm making this for, and what's going on in his life, and oh yeah, it's all kinds of stuff. But yeah, I pour myself into the piece, and you know, when you put 100 hours into a piece, sometimes it's tough to give it up. But you know, you're building it for a person. You have that person in mind while you're doing it, and so yeah, it's a natural thing to, well, kind of hard, but yeah, you need to give it up. Yeah,
it's like letting your children grow up, isn't it?
Well, it's yeah it's a comparison, but it's harder to give up your kids, believe you me.
When you get down on your knees tonight to thank the Lord for his guiding light and pray they turn out right, thank God for kids.
This is the first gun I made in 1985. What do I say about it? You start with the barrel, putting it into a chunk of wood. This particular barrel, and most of the guns I build are rifled barrels. The rifling is grooves that are cut about one turn in 66 inches. So it's a very slow twist, but it gives the ball, and we shoot a round lead ball with a cloth patch. That would be like your gasket that seals everything off and grips the rifling. But it gives that ball a spin, much like a fast ball is more stable than a knuckleball in the wind.
I understand that.
Yeah, so that's the purpose of the rifling. But anyhow, back to the barrel itself.
In just a moment after a break.
Thank God.
Pictures of Lowell Harrer at work in his shop and of some of the stunning flintlock rifles he's made on the Spark page at WMRA.org, as well as a link to Lowell's website. But don't leave us. We'll be back after the break to pick up where we left off, hearing more from Lowell Harrer about the fashioning of flintlocks. This is The Spark. I'm Martha Woodruff. Back before the break, I was visiting Lowell Harrer in the Rockingham County shop where he makes mostly flintlock rifles. Lowell, using the first flintlock rifle he made back in 1985 to demonstrate, was telling us how he usually starts with a rifled barrel. Rifling, or grooves cut with a slow twist, helps the round lead ball shoot straight and true. And now, as promised, back to the barrel itself.
This is what would be called a swamped barrel or a double taper. It's heavy here at the breech. The breech is where the actual load is stored before it's shot. And then it slenders down up toward what we would call the waist, about 6 to 12 inches from the muzzle. It's slim, and then it flares back out at the muzzle. And it does two things. It gives a length of the barrel without excessive weight, but it also adds artistic grace to the rifle. A nice, long, slender barrel, and then that flaring out the muzzle. To me, that's just part of the artistic design that is enhances it. But it brings the balance point of the rifle back where it's very, very manageable, handles very well. But start by putting the barrel in. Then you cut the profile from the side and mark a center line.
This is the wood part.
In the wood part, yes. Actually, let me back up. The barrel is the main object of the whole gun, but the stock is what holds it. That's the handle, basically, to hold the barrel. And so everything is mounted into the barrel. And again, I should say that I have a term that form follows function. Everything on the gun has a function, but while you're doing it, you make it artistic. And so that's the way they would have approached this.
Where'd you get this particular profile?
This is styled after an early Lancaster County, Pennsylvania gun. If you notice my website, I have a lot of early Virginia rifles. It's a little bit different profile, but this is the first one I did, and it tends to be a little bit more profiled after Lancaster County.
And what's the difference in those profiles?
Here on the comb is where the cheek would rest.
You got to define comb and cheek.
Okay.
Your cheek.
My cheek, yeah, will come against the comb of the rifle. This is the top of the buttstock. So when you shoulder the rifle, your cheek would rest there on the comb. On the Lancaster, that's straight. You can put a straight edge right along the center line. It should be straight. On the bottom edge, from the toe of the butt plate is what actually is against your shoulder when the gun is fired. From the toe of that, the bottom of it, up to just in back of the trigger a bit, that also is a straight line.
In Virginia, it would be different.
Whereas in Virginia, let me pick up another rifle here.
Right.
This one here, the top of the comb is just slightly curved, not much. It's just very subtle, but it's there. If you put a straight edge on there, you can see that it does have a slight curve to it. The toe is the same thing. It's got a slight curve. It's not very much, but if you put a straight edge on, you can see it. It's just little subtle things like that that you've got to be into it a while almost to see those see those little subtle things, but they are there. And it seems like each locality had their certain artistic elements that are in a gun. So when you study the originals, they would have had the apprentice system. So the apprentice would have learned from his master and picked up, we would say, his vocabulary of carvings and engravings, the elements of artistic design, would have picked up the vocabulary of his master. And so when he went on his own, his guns would look a whole lot like the master. And so those are called schools. I don't know why they're called schools, but they're called schools of gun making. And so as you study the originals, you can see, well, this is the Lancaster school, this is the York County school, and Lebanon County, and so on and so forth. And it's pretty defined that way. Okay, you get the barrel into the stock, and I should say next, even probably before you cut the profile, you have the profile very much in mind, but the lock goes in, that's the firing mechanism, and it's has to go at a certain place to get lined up right for the touch hole. The touch hole is the hole that goes to the side of the barrel into the main charge, and so that dictates where the lock is. Once that's in place, that dictates where the trigger has to be because of where the firing mechanism on the lock itself. Once the trigger is established, when you know the build of the customer, the length from the trigger to the butt plate is important. Then that can establish that length.
What do you get the customer to measure?
Well, there are complicated ways to measure a customer to get what is a proper fit. proper fit is much more important on a shotgun than a rifle, simply because a shotgun is a pointed weapon where a rifle is aimed. Generally speaking, you can adjust to the sights on a rifle easier than a shotgun where you just point. But anyhow.
Now, wait a minute. Okay? Talk about the difference between pointing and aiming, because I would use them interchangeably.
Okay. Aiming is using the sights. You have a rear and a front sight, to use those in a very precise way to get them lined up exactly on target. Where pointing is more instinctive. It would be like throwing a baseball. You can't aim it. You must instinctively throw it. How God designed us that way, I don't know, but that's the way we are. And so there is, in shotgun, in wing shooting, it's more of a pointed action.
Wing shooting?
Shooting birds on the wing.
Okay.
I use terms that I guess I'm used to.
Well, okay. Don't worry, I'll ask.
Okay, all right.
So you have fitted the lock and fitted the trigger.
Okay, and then the butt plate can be established, you know, depending on the length of, we would call it length of pull, or some would say trigger reach. Let's see, once you have that established, and then you can go several directions from there. The side plate is opposite of the lock. The purpose of the side plate, that's basically a fancy washer. Those two bolts go through the stock and hold the lock in tight against the barrel. And so rather than just stick an old washer on there, you make it fancy while you're at it. You know, artistic. And this particular gun, I've done engraving in the metal, artistic design in it, similar to what they would have had.
There are many more pieces of a flintlock rifle that Lowell Harrer has to construct, measure, install. Things like the side plate, the trigger guard, the grip rail, and then...
All the pieces are put together, and the final shaping is all done then. And once we do that, everything, like I was saying earlier, is rasped and filed and then sanded with coarse and finally down to fine and then whiskered. And we're ready for stain. At that point, I usually disassemble a lot of the gun.
Let me ask you one quick question. How about the carving? There's carving on this.
Okay, the carving is you would rough shape the gun just a little bit oversized, and that's just sort of a thing you need to learn by eye, I guess you'd say. There are certain things that, yeah, there are guidelines too, but some of it is just learning by doing. And then the carving is cut in, and that's what takes a lot of time. Obviously, as a woodworker all my life, I like the wood carving. That's a lot of work, but it's a lot of the beauty of the gun as well. And there are several kinds of carving. In basic terms, one would be incised carving, where the carving is simply cut into the wood. There you can finish the surface of the wood pretty much to where you want it, and then you cut the carving in and you're done. With raised carving, that's where you actually need to prepare a little oversized, and then the carving is all cut out. To me, I'm doing more than building guns. They have sentimental value to me. The one on the far edge of the table, that is the curly maple we looked at. That piece of wood comes from the home place where I grew up in Indiana. So when I did that class with Herschel House, I said, you know, I want one. This gun's a keeper. This will stay in my family. I'm going to use a piece of wood that came from my home place. It's very soft. The wood is actually too soft. And I was told when I was doing the class, don't use that piece of wood because it's too soft. I said, yes, but I'm going to follow my heart. That comes from my home place. I'm going to use it. This piece of walnut that this gun is made out of, that's rifle number 9 that I did. My wife's father and I cut that tree off of the home place where she grew up right after we moved here about 40 years ago. So I ended up making that rifle from that piece of wood that comes from her home place. That gun, again, is another one that needs to stay in the family. And so I'm building stuff. I follow my heart a lot when I'm doing this kind of thing. I just, you know, it's, I guess, the nature within me.
Flintlock rifle maker Lowell Harrer also makes period accessories, including really beautiful bone turkey collars. You'll find pictures from my visit, taken by Charlie Woodruff, along with a link to Lowell's website on the Spark page at WMRA.org.